Welcome to the AI Asia Pacific Institute podcast. The rise of AI presents important legal and ethical challenges for society. In this podcast, we invite leaders from different industries and creators of new AI to debate the big questions. This is the AI Asia Pacific Institute podcast. Hillary runs London-based not-for-profit Society Inside. The name is a riff on the famous brand IntelInside, and its focus is the desire that innovation should have the needs and values of people and planet at its heart, not simply the making of money. She explores the issues of trust, ethics, values, and governance of technology, AI, nanotech, biotech, and gene editing in particular, through collaborative research, exploring trustworthy process design, public speaking, coaching, mentoring, and acting as a critical friend to organizations of all types. She is director of the TIG Tech Initiative, which explores trustworthiness and trust in the governance of technology, was previously co-chair of the World Economic Forum Global Future Council on Values, Ethics, and Innovation, and member of its Agile Governance Council. She was recently named one of the 100 Brilliant Women in AI Ethics for 2021. With you now, our host for this podcast, Kelly Forbes.
Welcome, Hillary. It's great to have you here.
Hello, it's great to be here. I'm honored to be invited to talk to you. Thank you.
Excellent. So I think a lot of what we are going to cover here, it's going to be around the recent report published by TIG Tech, which is called Trust and Tech Governance. But perhaps a good place for us to start is with the definition, with the name Society Inside, which is actually another organization that you work with, and you can tell us more about as we go. But from what I understand, the name is sort of reflecting reverse engineer innovation. So it comes from the needs of society rather than just creating technologies which are in an eternal search for a home. So can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes, absolutely. I think so. Just to be clear with that, TIG Tech, Trust in Governance of Technology, is a project run by Society Inside, which is my organization. So, but Society Inside, I started in this world of responsible innovation in the 1990s, showing how old I am, when it used to be called CSR. And, you know, it gradually got to work at the more cutting edge areas of technology. In 2003, I started to get involved in nanotechnology because the questions that we're facing now with AI were just the same, which is how do we develop technologies that responsibly, that don't cause more problems than they solve? And I just had this little wheeze when I was naming my organization to have a riff off IntelInside. So the idea that society would be so embedded inside the development of all of these technologies that I work across, that they would be very different from the beginning. Instead of sort of bolting on the ethics and the responsibility issues afterwards when something bad has happened.
Right. So in moving a little bit to cover how, so exploring what TIG Tech is really researching there. So, and I think the big question that you have behind this project is how might tech governance differ and in what ways, if the earning of trust is considered and incorporated into governance, design, and delivery? So can you tell us more about this question and how you sort of unpacked that as you went with the project?
Yes, I mean, there were two starting points for this. One is that there's such a lot of conversation about the technology itself being trusted and trustworthy, but not about the governance of the technology, the regulation, the internal and external governance of the technology. So we see that with the COVID vaccine, for example, how the approval process of the vaccine is equally important to trust and the belief in the trustworthiness of the vaccine itself. So people don't want to get vaccinated if they think that it's been rushed through or they haven't scrutinized its effects. Yes. So you can see that with all sorts of tech, the governance, the regulation, what is that doing to keep me safe? So that was one aspect of our question. And it also came from the guy who invented this project or came up with this concept, worked in the biotech area. And he felt a little aggrieved that from GMO's point of view, they tried so hard to earn trust with the governance. They'd got liability regimes, they'd got public dialogue, they'd got endless iterations of even stricter technology, and still no one trusted them. And he was saying, what did we have to do? What should we have done differently? So those sort of two starting points were where we came together, me as an NGO and him as a business person. And that's where we then got involved with Fraunhofer Institute, the academic institute, looking at applied science to see how we can take this sort of thinking forward in a very practical way rather than a quite sort of top line academic way. And what could we do to help particularly actually those involved in developing governance, regulation, or perhaps multi-stakeholder initiatives, and also the companies themselves in terms of how they can articulate what they're doing with their own internal governance to demonstrate that they are trustworthy to us all.
Yeah, I really like your example there in relation to COVID. And we have seen that in many different ways as well. And I think when we were just talking about this before, some of the countries in Asia that have dealt really well with the pandemic, they also are known for the trust that population usually have in the government. So, you know, when during this period when they were told what to do, what the procedure should be, I think that was the big difference because the population knew that they could trust in that process, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. It seems to be like that. But again, people have surprised governments in COVID. You know, the UK, we're supposed to be so, you know, going our own way, individualistic, but we you know, on the whole, been relatively obedient, really. When, you know, when it's clear and we have consistent and clear, competent, you know, government guidance, then that's easier to follow, then people have responded quite positively. So there's been some surprises as well as, you know, unsurprises.
Yeah. So diving into, you know, trust and tech governance reports, you know, the report suggests new competences. Can we cover what they are and why they are important?
Yes, I think I'd like to just start from, you know, what causes distrust in governance. So, I mean, there are three things and areas that cause distrust, and therefore the competencies flip that round in terms of, you know, what can be done differently. So I think the main area of distrust in governance and in companies is that they are putting the making of money ahead of people and planet. And, you know, as we know, neoliberal capitalism doesn't help in that it indirectly incentivizes that. So there is no surprise that they're doing that because they're made to do that by the system. But when we see in all sorts of different technologies, but we also see in all sorts of problems not related to technology. So, for example, there's a report called Late Lessons from Early Warnings, which is a European Environment Agency, quite an old report now, but they analysed the big problems like chemical spills or all of those types of things. And what they looked at was, you know, what were the signals and what were the early warnings that we could see? And a lot of those were the values not being considered and the opinions and views of others giving you this feedback not being listened to and being ignored. So it's interesting that this idea of putting money first goes back to lots of problems, not just in tech, in all sorts of sort of disasters that's happened in society. And so that it was the starting point. But also from, again, we're looking at governance and we're looking at regulators mainly, but this is also true of companies. that they don't see the need to communicate well. You know, governance institutions are very aloof, very opaque, very sort of, we are, you know, we are who we are. We don't need to explain ourselves to you. And that's got to change. And there's some really good reports that I mentioned in the report, one from PA Consulting, which I liked, which is, if governance and regulators are changing from being this watchdog of industry, just nitpicking you and telling you you've got to jump through these hoops, to being champions of the public, champions of citizens, you sort of do different things, and you have to listen more to citizens, and you have to engage more, and you have to understand what a different role for governance may be in that different zone. And I think AI particularly has really flipped that model. And I think because of these social and ethical aspects of AI that weren't really the responsibility of governance institutions before. I mean, you know, what governance does quite well, which is, you know, based on old school health and safety, construction site, don't do this, do that, and I'm going to come and inspect you. You know, that's sort of really what governance was about. And a lot of the regulation is about, you know, proving, enforcing certain types of quite discrete and finite rules and, you know, regulations. And now these new technologies, particularly like AI, come along, and these are ethical issues. I mean, for example, bias in AI, really, that's basic human rights law and basic discrimination law, and yet it doesn't drop into that box in the regulatory framework. Facial recognition, should we use that? Shouldn't we use it? How should we use it? This whole surveillance capitalism sort of model of technology and digital for surveillance, that is not a do this, do that thing easily decided. You know, those are values issues. So regulators and governance institutions and governments having to dive into these really tricky areas of values and ethics and engaging citizens in deciding, and you work across different cultures, you know, very difficult, very different cultures, very different expectations, really difficult job. So that would be our second sort of finding, really, is that governance institutions now have to look at how they calibrate ethics and values and how they engage better. So citizens trust governance when they see it's working, which is sort of a real trite thing to say. But if they can see that it's working and baddies are punished, and unlike in the financial crash, for example, in Europe particularly, and the US, the baddies are still getting billions of dollars at the top of their companies, and nobody's punished, and we are all sort of the ones taking the hit, this undermines trust in the whole process and system of governance, if governance is not seen to work. And this is where AI is facing that now. You know, you've not managed it to really get a control over, you know, what's expected, what's needed, and how to manage this damage to society that some aspects of AI have wrought, but also optimize the benefits, because governance is not just about, you know, smacking the baddies, it's about facilitating and catalyzing good technology as well. So coming to then our three new competencies, we're saying that trust fundamentally is about, first, be trustworthy. And second, provide evidence that you are trustworthy. Because a lot of organizations, you know, and there was a very, very well respected ethical regulator in the UK, a digital regulator, who said, yeah, well, we like to just keep under the radar. And I'm sort of saying, why are you keeping under the radar when, you know, citizens want to see what you're doing? You know, citizens want you to help us know how, you know, what to be suspicious of and what not to be suspicious of. Not communicating doesn't help us. It's like, oh yeah, that's interesting. So we're saying to regulators, to governments and to businesses, give us evidence of your trustworthiness. So if you're looking at these, some of these frameworks like ethical AI or trustworthy AI or AI ethics frameworks, We see a lot of, on people's websites, we are signing up to that. So I know from 30 years of responsible, you know, CSR, signing up to the thing is just really, and it's a good thing. We like that. But actually, that is the starting point.
We so call it ethics washing, right? In a way.
Washing, that's right. So trust washing is another one. We want to earn trust. Trust is our watchword, but they don't necessarily go to what is it to be trustworthy. And trustworthiness, which I'm doing some work at the moment with some really interesting organizations. And what's actually really boring is that being trustworthy is really just a layer upon layer of small decisions to do something in a trustworthy way as opposed to not, or something in an ethical way as opposed to not. And so it's actually, you know, the nitty-gritty of ethical culture really is what helps be trustworthy. And the second one of our key competencies, particularly for governance, and this also applies across the board, is this, this idea that, you know, particularly with these ethical issues, particularly with these really complicated things. I was, you know, watching The Social Dilemma, as I'm sure you have, and so many people who might be watching have.
Yes.
I get lots of people sort of coming to, you know, total pals saying, oh, now I understand what you do. I didn't know. It's so frightening. So it's been great for my, you know, general sort of people understanding what I do. I have sympathy that inventing the like button, I mean, really, you'd sit there and you think, oh, you know, we can have the like button and everybody will like things and everybody will be really happy and sharing lovely stuff. And you have this little happy, happy vision for the for what would happen. You really would find it tricky to know that it's going to be the single cause of negative mental health, you know, in society, you know, not the single most, but, you know, one of the most important. That is a tough call. And that requires a much more rounded, diverse approach to innovation and to the governance. To find that the like button could be so bad, you know, even if you had academics telling you all that, you still probably wouldn't listen because you wouldn't believe them. So this is, you know, I'm not saying this sort of trustworthy AI is easy. It's really tricky. But what will make it easier is this concept of collaborative governance and doing as a lot of the AI organizations are, which is with stakeholders and with citizens. So the second of our key competencies, we're calling building trusted environments. So in order for someone to want to be part of your ethics committee, and we all know who we're talking about, to be part of your governance design process, to be part of your, you know, really innovative regulatory design process across different regulators for something in AI, you know, people need to trust the process. People need to think, okay, they've got a good intent with this process. They're competent. They can run this process. They're going to be inclusive. The process is going to be fair and it's going to be open and they're going to respect my opinion. So, okay, I can join this process. I can join with this organization. And so this idea of building a trusted environment so that people will collaborate with you, we think is a key competency for regulators and for companies. And the third one, which I think in a way is the most difficult, but also really important, is the involvement of citizens. And you take that, I'm saying involvement, not engagement. So, and I'm saying citizens, not consumers. So I read some great work from an organization called the New Citizenship Company. And they did some research that if we call us consumers, we act very, quite selfishly. But if we're called citizens, if we're dealt with respectfully as citizens, we're much more altruistic. And it's sort of interesting, I think, that. So that's why we call it not consumers. And the involvement of citizens, not just this thing, which is market research. What do you think about, you know, AI, you know, which is, you know, well, what is AI? AI is about 100 different things. That's a daft question to start with. So there are lots of innovative methodologies, lots of interesting ideas around the involvement of citizens in governance. And that means companies, but it particularly means, you know, governments and regulators. And, you know, there's a lot of very innovative work going on there. But what's the most important part of that, and the most important part of that competence seems to me, is that actually you have to have this information, but you have to listen to it, you have to take it seriously, and you have to embed it back into the design of your product process governance. And probably the biggest finding, or the most sort of valuable to me finding of my last 30 years and of this report, is the real difficulty of taking seriously the opinion of somebody whose opinion you don't take seriously because you don't like them, or they're not relevant, or who are they anyway? I mean, they're just citizens. I mean, it's a plumber. I mean, what can I learn from a plumber? I'm an AI technologist, for goodness sake, I know best. But we're all like this. You know, I always think of Donald Trump. How am I going to respect and take seriously the opinion of Donald Trump? That's a hard thing, but I'm now finding, you know, what a lot of the work with building trusted environments and the trust work shows that people trust people and individuals, organizations, governments for lots of really different reasons. They trust, you know, and a lot of it, it's really complicated. And in fact, it's so complicated that it's not helpful for my report to have this observation. But, you know, we trust someone partly based on our genetics and predispositions. So a lot of the behavioral science on risk aversion or optimism bias, body chemistry even, bizarrely, is quite important. That potentially predisposes you to be optimistic and pessimistic, trust people more or trust people less. Then your upbringing, you know, a narrow upbringing with a very small number of people who are trustworthy, or a broader upbringing where, you know, lots of diverse voices are taken seriously. And then your identity and worldview. So, you know, if you're brought up and your experiences, so for example, an experience, if you've been discriminated systematically, you know, from an early age, as many groups and individuals have, you might trust the algorithm far more than the person. But if you're a little old white lady who's never been particularly discriminated against, in, you know, you're not going to trust the nasty techie algorithmy thing. You know, you might trust the person. So all of these things go together to make a trust decision. And that's what actually, when you start to be more empathetic and thoughtful and compassionate about people's different reasons for trusting and distrusting, that allows you to listen and understand and be more sort of compassionate or empathetic or understanding, at least, of opinions and people who you don't share at first point, at least, the values and the ethics of their particular approach.
That's so interesting, right? Because what you just mentioned there about how we are all biased, it's exactly the argument that a lot of the tech companies use. And specifically, I think when we think about HR industry or hiring process and so on, how they're deploying technologies that can now make decisions about who is the right person for the job or who is the right person to be promoted and so on. So the argument is that if we have a system that can take away that bias that we humans have on a decision where we judge people by appearances, by how they speak, what language they speak, where they're from, how they dressed, and so on, then we are going to arrive in this, you know, perfect scenario, right? Which is, you know, well, it would be nice, but I find that very difficult to see that happening in practice, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the vision is a worthy vision. And I love that, you know, one of the starters of this was I think it might have been even a British orchestra who did blind auditions, and they realized they weren't actually choosing to be part of musically in part of an orchestra based on their biases. So the auditions are blind. So this idea of blind auditions is a good one. You know, it's not a terrible idea. However, there's so much richness in the ability of someone to contribute to an organization that little tiny tick boxes really don't do it. And I read something this morning which I liked, Cathy O'Neill, I think it said, algorithms are opinions encoded. I really like that, I'd not heard that before. And that's it, an algorithm is an opinion. It's a load of people's opinions all crammed in, and then regurgitated out as wisdom. And wisdom there aren't, it's just a collection of opinions. So if that is your aim, to have, you know, blind, you know, auditions, that in its own right is not going to be achieved through an algorithm that has is biased in that way. But also, the other thing about things like positive discrimination or all of those sorts of ways of valuing different people, you know, we all know, you know, our partners and collaborators and you know, people that we work with, you can't codify easily someone's value to an organization. So to sort of pretend it's that simple is really just not, you know, not really a valid opinion, really, I think. But to pursue that as a goal with technology as a possibility, I think is a worthy goal. But just don't overpromise, you know. I mean, that's great. That's what I think about AI, is just followed in the long line of technologies that hype themselves into a froth of expectation. And the system makes them do that. My friend Richard Jones, Professor Richard Jones, is a physicist at Sheffield, calls it the economy of promises. I mean, you don't get money for investment or science or technology from governments or companies unless you hype the solution that you're going to provide to society into the stratosphere. And no wonder, you know, a mere ordinary algorithm can't quite deliver that off the bat. So I think, you know, I have some sympathy with the way the system really incentivizes, you know, a lot of this overhyped, overpromising. You know, it's not just trying to make money. You know, you have to do that or else you don't get off the ground.
Yeah, absolutely. So you mentioned Kathy there, and she was talking to us last week, actually. One of the things that she mentioned there, to your point about how, you know, technologists have a certain view of this, which might be different from the rest of the population. And going back to, you know, how you mentioned that as a third point, the involvement of citizens, I think, she highlighted a question that I thought it was very helpful, which is a question that she often asks organizations is, who does this technology fail to? So we need to recognize that it doesn't work in the same way to everyone. You know, there's differences here. And so the people that are being impacted by it, who are they? And how can we mitigate this?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, but that is a question across, you know, all sorts of organizations and all sorts of technologies. Who are we negatively impacting? How do we even know that? How are we even understanding that, measuring that, thinking about that? But also, this is a very interesting aspect of that, which is the context. So, for example, you know, we've seen with Black Lives Matter, we've seen with Me Too, we've seen with, you know, how difficult and how society doesn't do that easily unless there's some great big problem. And so one of the things that I see is difficult. I did my master's thesis in this, actually, that people, you know, organizations, society in general, really respond best when something really bad has happened. And only then do we get our act together to think about that person that is, is been disadvantaged. But in the meantime, you know, before that, we really didn't really think about it. And so you have to wait for a catalogue of disasters to sort of like push you into thinking of things. And we've got plenty in AI now, so we're not short of those. but I think that it's very difficult to do that. It's organizationally quite difficult to do that. And it's very difficult also to sort of to really understand how to respond, you know, as a small, medium, even a very large organization to this. So if you're, you know, I just did a booklet for the World Economic Forum. I was co-chair of the Values and Ethics and Innovation Council. And, you know, little tiny companies, we talked to really small companies. So there's one called Yoti, which is looking at digital identity is their area of work. Really interesting. And they have a board of guardians to help them bring these, you know, what do we call them now? Hard to reach groups or unintended consequence groups and help remind them of that, but they get out there and talk to them. And one great example of this, they were looking at doing some sort of digital key for refugees who don't have papers and who these days, you know, your identity, you know, is just essential in terms of, you know, being part of a society. And so they went to talk to the refugees and they said, well, one of the things that's really important is this digital key has got to be swallowable. Okay, swallowable, okay. Because when the army come or when, you know, people, the baddies come, we need to be able to be rid of it and they can't take it from us and hack it. So we need, and you know, you don't get that learning from a brainstorm with your pals in third floor conference room B. You only get that out there talking to people. But you know, I really admire what they're doing because digital identity is a really tricky area and the misuse of identity and even facial recognition and all of the you know, the technical issues with digital identity. But they're really trying very hard and doing some very innovative thinking on how to make that work for everyone.
Yeah, and I think one of the biggest challenges we have with artificial intelligence is exactly the fact that most of the population are not necessarily aware of these big issues, these big challenges. A lot of the times, decisions are being made about their lives and they're not necessarily aware of it until something goes wrong, like you just mentioned, right?
Yeah, because I'm doing some work in the UK with our, which involved discussions with our sort of centres for cybersecurity and some of the digital people in the digital area. And they actually say, you know, the general feeling is we need to increase societal trust. You know, that is, everybody said we must increase trust. And they're saying, no, society is far too trusting. Far too trusting. Do not increase societal trust anymore. This is a really bad idea, which I thought was a very interesting point. And I was talking to some really interesting people as part of our consultation who actually said, you know, sort of off the record, if society knew how dreadfully incompetent lots of governance is, you know, they really would be horrified. That actually the enforcement doesn't really happen and, you know, we haven't really got the resources and, you know, all of these things, you know, so don't increase trust, decrease trust and then increase vigilance, you know, increase vigilance rather than trust, which I hadn't thought of and I thought was quite an interesting perspective to have.
Yeah. So vigilance, and that I guess brings back to, I want to just take one step back to our conversation earlier, which was around soft law. And at the beginning of this, you also mentioned a little bit about regulation and essentially how law is behind innovation in a way, because we are in this obscure area where we don't know what belongs to law, what belongs to ethics, and so, you know, the responses is low. Now, what are your recommendations and views there in terms of, so we briefly discussed soft law there, and from what I understood is that it's not sufficient, right? We need more.
Yeah, we need more. I think, and so I've been involved peripherally with an organization in Arizona State University doing some work on soft law that works, because the sort of general accepted wisdom is that self-regulation doesn't work. And yet, you know, obviously companies are, you know, saying, you know, we can be trusted with this. Look, we have the, you know, AI for good. We don't worry, we've got it sorted. And yet history shows that that's not necessarily the case, partly from the incentives and the disincentives to do that. So, you know, what is okay for soft law and what needs to be hard regulated? And particularly importantly, how can you enforce regulation? I was happening to see the Modern Slavery Act in the UK, which has been trumpeted as a marvelous thing. And all organizations have to do is have to write once a year what they're doing to combat slavery. They don't have to actually combat any slavery. and they're not judged on it. And then they don't even have to, they're not even evaluated on it. So, you know, that to me is some sort of knee-jerk law in response to a societal problem that is not fit for purpose, that is not trustworthy governance. I was just a bit horrified with that because I somehow thought it worked that, and that Modern Slavery Act was a really good thing. But it's almost worse than having no governance at all. But in that area, some of the modern slavery NGO initiatives are affecting change. So you can see in that area, which is perhaps a little bit more evolved, that some things, you know, alongside hard law and soft law is what will work. But I think also, you know, if we see companies still doing the same things, if we don't see this soft law actually working, then, you know, societal trust is not going to follow. And in fact, you know, one of the things we sort of see, and I haven't got stats particularly, but when the governance of the financial sector, for example, didn't work in the financial crash, and those were not penalized, and they're still there taking their six-figure salaries, or their eight, how many, one, two, three, five, six, seven-figure salaries, and nobody's been punished, this undermines trust in the whole system of governance, the whole system of regulation, because the big cheeses, as usual, you know, nothing happens to them. And this is what is happening with AI, in that, you know, they're finding it difficult, genuinely difficult, because AI can cross seven different, you know, regulatory agencies. It's not an easy thing. But it's actually undermining our trust in all sorts of governance.
Yeah. Unless we have a response there, it impacts many different areas.
Yes.
So is it coming? What do you think? What can we expect in terms of what the future holds there?
What the future holds? Well, you know, that's interesting, isn't it? I have no idea, because that's one of the things that I know is, you know, there is, you know, the truism that we underestimate the effect of technology in the short term and overestimate the impact of technology in the short term, underestimated it in the longer term. So I have no idea. But I look around at AI. I look around at neurotechs. I'm involved in a lot of these different sorts of tech in this sort of top level, neurotech, cognitive enhancement, biotech, nanotech, you know, all of these tech are coming together and converging. But also what I do see is society getting a bit mad about it. And I do see that, you know, COVID has really helped with that, actually. We're starting to see what we value and what, you know, and we find that actually we value, you know, delivery drivers more than we value stockbrokers. The people who are creating value for society aren't the ones who are getting the money. But also, you know, there are new and innovative things coming about, which, like, for example, well-being metrics instead of GDP, stakeholder capitalism instead of, you know, ordinary shareholder value. And so I can see that these new innovative metrics and these sort of, and society really cranking up expectation, I think will be a pincer movement, which I think will help catalyze, you know, AI for good. And I think what I liked about the social dilemma, and you know, you hear, I'm on a panel next week with Brad Smith from Microsoft, and you hear, you know, they actually do mind, and they do care, I like the fact that Google's employees are driving the organization to change. Yeah. And I sort of see this pincer movement everywhere, but it's the practice. It's let's just see it in practice and show us in practice, not just words. So I think the future for AI is maybe, could you say, in the balance? It's always going to be there. Of course it is. It's only data. It's only software. It's actually not, until we get the singularity, it really is software. How we make it work for good and how we avoid it, the bad, I think, is tipping in a positive direction, I think.
Yeah.
So I'm hopeful. But then, you know, my predisposition is that I'm a hopeful and optimistic person. So, of course, I'm going to think that.
Yeah, no, this is a great response to a very complex question, which I usually keep it to the end. But taking a step back now, Hillary, to something that you wrote today, which is around what happens when, and there is a word, there's a specific word that you share on that, which I don't have in front of me right now, but it's essentially around, I think, addressing a lot of what these big tech companies are leaving, which is essentially once trust is destroyed, or once trust, there wasn't really trust there, or if trust is not an option because citizens don't have another option, right? Which is the case. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Yes, this is a term that I very thankfully got from our Academy of Medical Sciences, Liz, who told me about this. This is resigned trust. And it came about from some public dialogue that was done in 2014 on public understanding of science and attitudes to science. And it's about this feeling, I don't even trust you, but I have no choice. So I'm going to have to act like I trust you. But I just feel really, you know, disgruntled, yeah, disappointed with having to be made to make this choice. So this resigned trust. So actually, from an organizational perspective, it might look like trust. So many people are using our platform, you know, and you can have lots of little metrics that say that people really trust us, but actually they don't trust you. They don't trust you, or they might trust you in different domains. So one of the things about trust, it's quite, you know, it's quite contextual. You don't distrust your plumber because they can't mend your computer, and you don't distrust the civil aviation authority for not, you know, managing the bank crash. So, you know, trust is quite discreet in some ways. And actually, you can trust, say, a platform technology to give you a good search engine or to, you know, put you in touch with your mates, but you don't trust their use of the data. Or you're suddenly realizing that, you know, you are searching, but you're not getting, you're being driven into a direction that you didn't know, but you still haven't got any choice. You still got to use them. And this sort of residual distrust of the system, of companies in general, of governments for not getting their act together to prevent it, just, you know, erodes trust in society in general. And I think this is a real danger. And we see there's a great report I can recommend to people called from Ipsos Mori called Trust the Truth. And it says actually trust is not falling dramatically all over the world, like we have mentally think that it is true. But actually what is coming out is a sort of feeling of the need to be trustworthy and questions about what that means. And the World Value Survey of last year said that citizens are losing trust because even governments are not being trustworthy in terms of responding to what they care about, the rule of law or, you know, the actual well-being of citizens in general. So, you know, that's another tipping point for where we are. If we are sort of gradually eroding trust, where does that take us? You know, where does that take us? And that, you know, the sort of response to that is all of us, actually citizens as well, just being, you know, thinking, how do we be more trustworthy? And how do we give evidence of our trustworthiness again? Back to Baroness Honora O'Neill, who wrote that great phrase about first be trustworthy and then provide good evidence that you are trustworthy.
And so the theme of Davos this year is very timely because it's rebuilding trust. So how do you suggest now that organizations approach this recommendation when it comes to artificial intelligence, right? So thinking about those organizations that are building these solutions and also the ones that are deploying, right?
Well, I think we've been covering all of that throughout. So, but you know, in fact, someone from the WEF was doing a presentation on trust and borrowed my slides, some of my slides. And what he said was really interesting was that he hadn't appreciated that this notion of trustworthiness as the starting point was actually quite challenging and not new as such, but the emphasis on trustworthiness instead of the emphasis on rebuilding trust. Because what I found with our research as well is that people talk about rebuilding trust. That's really a sort of how do we get them to trust us? What, how do we communicate with them better? How can we, they don't understand us, you know. I even had someone tell me once, Hillary, the public have a duty to understand nanotechnology. You know, then they would be understanding us and then they would trust us, you know. So that's still just a little bit in there, you know, this deficit model of understanding. And then once they understand, they'll all know that it's all going to be fine. So I would just say, speak, and I would say rebuilding trustworthiness. I would say to the WEF, which I have actually, take that out and put rebuilding trustworthiness and have a conversation about that instead.
Fantastic. Well, really enjoyed this conversation. Before you go, can you share with everyone where they can find you and read more about your work?
Yes, indeed. So the trust work is in a dedicated website we have for that called TIG Tech. So www.TIGTECH.org. So have a little look. And my, you know, I don't know about contact details, but my contact details are on the report. So please get in touch.
Yeah, we will have links for the reports as well in the publication. Thank you so much, Hillary, for taking the time. And thanks, everyone, for listening.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody.